Hey, Unchained listeners. As you know, it's hard keeping up with the fast-paced world of crypto, so we've got just the thing for you. Subscribe to our free Unchained Daily newsletter at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. You'll get the latest crypto news and original articles from our reporters, as well as summaries of other happenings in bullet points, plus our meme of the day, all curated and written by our amazing team. It's still your no-hype resource for all things crypto, just in newsletter form. Sign up at unchainedcrypto.substack.com. Again, the URL is unchainedcrypto.substack.com. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Unchained, a podcast engineered by Fractal Recording and produced by me, your host, Laura Shin, a Forbes contributor covering cryptocurrencies and blockchain. Thanks for tuning in. I am running a survey on Unchained. If you haven't already, please fill it out to get a say on what topics the show should cover, which guests we should have on, and whatever other improvements you'd like to suggest. You can make your voice heard at surveymonkey.com/r/unchained or find the link in the show description of this episode. Again, that's surveymonkey.com/r/unchained. And thank you to all of you who have submitted really fantastic suggestions so far. Also, if you've been enjoying this podcast, please share it on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or with any friends or colleagues who might be interested in the show. Also, please rate, review, or subscribe to Unchained on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. That helps get word out about the show. I'd like to extend a big thank you to our sponsor, OnRamp. Branding isn't just a logo. Your brand is the essence of who you are and what you offer your customers. OnRamp is a full-service creative and design agency that provides its clients with concise and exceptionally designed branding, websites, and marketing materials that will resonate with your audience, affect its purchase decisions, and ultimately grow your business. You can learn more at thinkonramp.com. Today, I have two guests. The first is William Mugayar, general partner at Virtual Capital Ventures, an early-stage venture capital fund, founder of Startup Management, and author of The Business Blockchain. William is also a board member of OB1 and a board advisor to the Ethereum Foundation. Joining him is Nick Tomeno, principal at early-stage venture fund Runa Capital, and author of the blog and email newsletter The Control, which is about token-based blockchain protocols. Welcome, William and Nick.
How's it going?
Hi, Laura.
William, let's start with you. Tell us what your background was before you got into the space and how you stumbled onto cryptocurrency.
Sure. I've been in technology for close to 35 years, the first 14 years being at HP, Hewlett-Packard. And in 95, I left HP to dive into the internet. And I was doing very much similar things to what I'm doing now, which is to write about it. I wrote two books at the time. And I used to do a lot of speaking engagements and was involved with startups that were early in the internet days. More recently, I did two startups, sold the last one in 2012, and then discovered the Bitcoin world.
And how did you discover it?
Via Fred Wilson's blog initially. And the first time I saw it, I was still too busy with my startup engage you at the time.
People who don't know, that's Fred Wilson, who is one of the VCs at Union Square Ventures.
Yes. And then as soon as we sold Engageo, then I had a bit more liberty to doing whatever I wanted. And I was lucky that I was living in Toronto. I am still living in Toronto. And this is where Vitalik Buterin, the inventor of Ethereum, is from. And I got exposed to him and met him when he was writing his paper. And when I started to read the paper and talk to Vitalik, it dawned on me very quickly that this thing was really going to get not just big, but important. I saw very quickly the fact that this was a paradigm shift in terms of how software applications were going to be written, and that this was something that could be as significant as the internet 20 years ago. And for the first time, specifically, the fields of cryptography, the fields of peer-to-peer technologies, and decentralized methodologies were all coming together for the first time and working in harmony. So it wasn't just about sending money peer-to-peer. It was more that this was a new paradigm that was going to allow engineers, software engineers, to write applications in new fundamental ways. So it was really a technology that was disrupting technology. That's how I described it in my book. But the same way with the internet and the web, it was a new technology that was disrupting the previous paradigm of client-server. And
what does that mean, client-server?
Client-server is the way that applications used to be written before the web, meaning that there is a computer, a server, that would serving the resources and the computational power to programmers that would be on their client. So the web brought a new paradigm, which was still within the client-server paradigm, but it used new technologies, the Java technologies and the browser technologies, and the fact that the clients became more smart and more powerful. So with the blockchain, we are doing another iteration of that model, where the resources are not just on servers, but they are in the cloud, which means that they are all over the globe. There could be thousands of nodes that are spread out. So you can think of the blockchain from a technological perspective as another evolution of cloud computing, but that has a very strong peer-to-peer component, which means that it is not just for the corporate world, but it is really brought into for the reach of anybody. So anybody can have a node, anybody can be part of the infrastructure, and that's a new paradigm that we are just entering right now.
So Nick, tell us a little bit about yourself. What was your background before getting into cryptocurrency, and how did you end up working in the industry?
Sure. So before I joined Coinbase, I was in business school, actually, on the East Coast. And actually, I guess before that is when I really discovered Bitcoin, similar to William and most people. You know, I heard about it on the internet. And I think the first thing I read about it was the famous Wired article in 2011, The Rise and Fall of Bitcoin, that described how Bitcoin kind of, grew from nothing to over, $30 per coin, and then crashed back down. And so I think, like a lot of people, I was kind of drawn in by, the speculation and the discussions of Silk Road and things like that. But quickly, I, fell down the rabbit hole and started engaging online in different communities, the main one being the Bitcoin subreddit. And then in 2013, when I right when I started business school, is when I kind of decided that I wanted to make a career out of it. And so in 2013, I basically talked to as many different entrepreneurs in the space as I possibly could. And a lot of the entrepreneurs that I talked to then are now either in jail or just not around anymore. So that was kind of interesting and kind of told me where the space was. I think that's kind of the people element of this industry. I think it is massively undervalued, and there's a lot of kind of excitement about, about funding and prices. But a lot of people don't take the time to sit down and like talk with the people that are kind of working in this space. And that's kind of what I did in 2013, and identified Brian Armstrong as kind of the most credible founder by far in the space. And so quickly, ended up working for Coinbase while going to business school for about 9 months, and then moved out to California from New Haven, Connecticut, and have been out here ever since. So that was kind of how
I got started. You were working in biz dev at Coinbase?
Yeah, a lot of different things in the early days. So I joined kind of working remotely when there were about 5 employees, and doing things like managing the Twitter account and most of the kind of external communications on the blog, things like that. And also kind of in the early days, a lot of the merchant outreach.
Great. And then when did you leave and go to Runa Capital? And also, when did you launch the Control?
So I left about a year ago to join Runa, and launched the control about 4 months ago now, so right at the beginning of the year.
And what prompted you to launch the control?
I think it's still very early in the space, and there's a lot of education that needs to be done. And so, you know, I was writing a lot of our stuff at Coinbase, you know, in the early days. And I think, you know, Coinbase has done and continues to do a really good job making the technology kind of relatable to non super technical people. And I think there's a lot more of that that can be done. And so that kind of prompted me to, you know, to launch the control. And it's kind of a reason also that we're, you know, we're working on Token Summit and things like that. And I think, you know, I also think you kind of do one of the best jobs of any in the, you know, in the journalism world of covering the space. I think there's still not a ton of good journalism. And so that's kind of the control allows me to, one, stay kind of in the space as much as I can as like a side project while also investing at Runa.
Yeah, because Runa does not invest in the space. Is that correct?
I wouldn't say we do not invest in the space. We're actively interested in the space, but we are a Series A venture fund. And the reality is there's not there have not been a ton of Series A opportunities for companies with real business traction. And, you know, within Runa, I'm a big believer in the space, but, you know, other than me, there's not someone who is just, you know, really excited about the future.
Okay. So I actually want to devote most of this episode to discussing the token trend and ICOs and all things of that ilk. And I've discussed this topic with multiple guests in different ways since last summer. Some of the previous episodes that touch on this were an episode I did with Jerry Brito and Peter Van Valkenburg of Coin Center. Another one I did somewhat recently with Olaf Carlson Wee of Polychain Capital, who is also a former Coinbase employee, and Brock Pierce of Blockchain Capital and Stan Mirochnik of the Argonne Group. And for listeners, I'll link to these past episodes in the show notes. But I would like to discuss the trend in depth with both of you, since, William, you're organizing the Token Summit that Nick mentioned, and that's in New York on May 24th and 25th. And Nick, you're also a co-host for that event. Why did you decide to launch the summit? Like, very broadly, how would you describe kind of like what is happening now and how it's different from what we've previously seen in the crypto space?
Sure. I felt late last year in 2016 that there was a need to dive more specifically into the world of the token-based economy, which is something that Nick and I kind of talk about. And I felt that there was so much activity going on in the space that I wanted to bring all of the top players, mostly the entrepreneurs and the investors and the whole sector, basically, that was at the forefront of this this new sector, which is one of the sectors of the blockchain, together.
And how do you describe this to people? Like, you know, when you're trying to explain to someone who isn't really familiar with what's happening, what do you say?
What I'm saying here, what we are saying here, is that the cryptocurrency is the first application of the blockchain. So that gave us Bitcoin, and it gave us Ethereum and many other cryptocurrencies. But that's only one element. What's really interesting, the real interest here, is the intersection of the cryptocurrency with the business model. So when you hear about all of these new tokens or cryptocurrencies that are being raised right now, I'm not so excited about having new currencies and new tokens per se, but I am more excited when I hear of a new business model that is enabled by the token or by the cryptocurrency. So I'm going to use the words token and cryptocurrency interchangeably because they kind of are very similar, a very, very similar thing. So I am more excited about how a given token, which is a kind of currency, is going to enable us, users, society, government, whoever, to do things that we could not do before. And that's the frontier that I think we're barely scratching the surface on right now.
And what's an example of something that it will enable us to do that wasn't possible before?
So for example, if you take the reputation markets, where you vote with a token. So the token could be representative of an ownership for the user. And this is something we could not do before, at least not very easily. So the token is like a tool for the user that can be used as part of the application. There are other examples where the token is something that a user earns by giving their attention. So if you spend time, let's say, on a site like Steemit, where you are writing some content and the content is being upvoted or it's being liked, it's being shared. As you do that, you are earning tokens, which you can not just earn, but you can spend. So what's going on here, I'm interested in exploring how mini economies, which I call circular economies, get formed, where a user is earning tokens and is able to spend those tokens at the same time in the same setting. So if I'm earning tokens because of users are giving me attention, I can spend those same tokens to maybe boost my content or to promote it or to buy services in that marketplace. So that's kind of the more exciting element. And there will be many examples like that. In the past, just to give you an analogy, governments used to issue money. So we are used to governments issuing sovereign money and currency, whether it's the dollar or the pound or the euro and so on. But in the future, companies are going to be issuing their own currency. And the currency that the companies will issue is going to have to be tied in to their products, to their services. So the next trend I'm seeing is not just startups and companies that are issuing the token and starting something new, but we're going to see established companies that already have millions of users issuing tokens as well, and then linking that token with an existing usage that already is taking place, but giving it a boost and allowing the users to earn currency via their actions, via their attention, via their data, via the fact that they have an ownership of sorts, whether they have a right to do something, could be a vote, could be an opinion, it could be an action. So we're going to see a variety of these types of functions. So that's really the incentive for the Token Summit. I want to explore all of these different ideas and models and functionality of the token. So the token is like a utility.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Yeah, and the reason that these developers or companies are not using an existing cryptocurrency like Bitcoin or Ether is because they want to be able to control the incentives within their little mini economy or their circular economy. Is that the reason?
That's one of the reasons. So these cryptocurrencies are their own. So they are like proxies to the back end currencies, like right now, the back-end currencies, in my opinion, are either Ether or Bitcoin proper. So they are like the backbone of the crypto world. What's interesting, if you have your own currency, you can have your own governance. So each currency now becomes their own kind of mini government per se. Maybe government is a big word. It's a body that is governed in a decentralized manner where users have a say, where there is oversight and there is transparency. So these companies are issuing these currencies so they can have their own governance models. But also another reason is because it's real money. So they are using this as a funding mechanism as well. And hopefully we'll talk about that in the segment.
Yeah.
Because there's goods and bads about it. There's some good elements about the fact that it becomes a new funding mechanism. But the caution here is that I'm seeing some projects getting funded just because it's easier to raise money with a crowdsourced manner by raising a token.
Yeah, I do want to dive into that in a big way. but before we do that, I just kind of want to give readers a perspective on just how big this trend is, or readers, listeners. I did a little bit of math, and I think it's like, and tell me if you have a different number, but I think it's north of 350 million so far that have been raised in these initial coin offerings. Is that roughly your estimate?
Yes, that's pretty close to, yes. Between last year, 2016, and more or less the first quarter of 2017, we're close to that number. I had predicted originally, just 2 months ago, that we would reach 600 million in 2017. And I am pretty sure that we're going to exceed that number.
So wait, raised only in 2017 or for
17? Yeah,
in including 2016. Oh wow, okay.
Oh yeah, I think we're going to reach $1 billion very easily. There are some big raises that are coming on the horizon that I cannot talk about yet, not announced yet, but they will be announced in the May and June timeframes, and for the rest of the 2017 year. Some companies are getting ambitious. So I wouldn't be surprised if we reached $1 billion in money raised via new cryptocurrency offerings in that year alone.
And what other stats really stick out to you as the most eye-opening?
Almost on a daily basis, there is a new one. So this is almost, I mean, right now we are able to monitor them and count them, but there'll come a point where it's going to be like another startup has been founded. So, like, big deal. So if you look at the traditional venture capital world, there are hundreds of startups being founded on a daily basis, on a global basis. So founding a startup and raising money is not a big deal anymore. There are VC companies that don't even announce any more fundings because it's a event. What's more important is what's getting done with the money. So I wouldn't be surprised that at some point in time, it won't be news anymore that a company is raising $10 million or $12 million via a token offering.
Okay. Yeah, I also feel like this trend is moving in that direction. At least for now, we'll see. But let's hold that thought and go to an important word from our sponsor, OnRamp. The best companies in the world obsess about branding. Killer branding will transcend your company and strategically and competitively position you in the market. Done well, a remarkable brand will affect buyers and their purchase decisions and give your organization a voice that sets you up for long-term success. OnRamp is a full-service creative agency that helps its clients maximize brand awareness, gain market momentum, and accelerate growth. Whether it's branding and identity for a new startup, redesigning an existing website to generate traffic and leads, or executing a custom design project or marketing strategy, OnRamp will get your organization strategically poised for the future. You can learn more and see examples of its work at thinkonramp.com. I'm speaking with William Mugayar, General Partner at Virtual Capital Ventures, and Nick Tomeno, Principal at Early Stage Venture Fund, Runa Capital, and Founder of The Control, both of whom are hosting the Token Summit on May 24th and 5th. So let's quickly run through some of the details around tokens. Who are the people launching them? What is the process for launching them? What structures, what kinds of entities are they creating to launch them, et cetera? Just run through that quickly.
Yeah, so I would say that this is kind of rapidly evolving, and it's still very early in how these entities are forming. And I think you know, people call them companies, and the analog in the traditional world is a company, but they're really not companies. And I think it's best to think of them as decentralized autonomous organizations, where there's an entrepreneur and a founding team, but there's no legal entity, and there's a number of different participants that play different roles in kind of bringing this entity to the world. But I really think of these structures as internet tribes, and they're kind of tribes that are focused on different use cases and have different beliefs. But at the end of the day, they're collections of people from all over the world that own a token and have ownership in a product and kind of want to bring the product to the world. So that's kind of how I view what's happening. I think the problem right now that's happening is there's, you know, if you, the over $350 million in funding over the past 12 months, the vast majority of these projects are getting funding before there's an actual product. And if you look at like the past 10 years in startups broadly outside of like the blockchain world, pretty much every company that has raised a lot of money pre-product has failed. Some of the famous examples are Klinkl, which was a mobile payments company that raised $25 million before a product in seed funding and disappeared in 2 years. Color and Airtime are other examples of this that raised kind of massive rounds before an actual product. And I think right now the token sales are being, like William said, are kind of in a lot of cases being used as funding first. And I think this model over time will change. And we're already seeing it change to some extent, where a founding team is raising a small seed round from more traditional investors, getting to a product, and then doing a token sale to give users access to the product. And this is kind of, again, it's still very early, and we haven't seen kind of best practices for how these organizations are structured, but this is kind of how I see a best practice playing out in the future.
Yeah, that's true, Nick. So there's no right or wrong way to do the token sale. It could be before the product is ready, it could be after, it could be before funding from a traditional VC or after. And the way I've divided the phases to answer your question, Laura, is I see four phases. There is the launch, but in this case, the launch is really the launch of the token itself or of the funding, if that is the case. Then there's a development. In many cases, the funding will allow the development to take place, the software development, and that could take 1 or 2 years. And in that development phase, I'm referring to the third phase, which is it goes into a darkness period. So we don't really know what goes on, despite transparency attempts from the startup. Because at the end of the day, these companies are like startups, whether they are a protocol or a distributed organization or an organization with a new product, they are really like a startup. So you cannot escape the startup characteristics, which means that it takes a while for the product to become more mature. It takes a while to acquire users. It takes a while to iterate on the actual vision that you have, because nobody is right from the beginning. Time will tell really what happens. And then the last phase is really the rollout, which is the market entry. And that could be a year or 2 years, and sometimes 3 years after the initial funding.
Okay, yeah, I actually, Nick, when you were saying that, oftentimes in history, we've seen that companies that raise a lot of money initially before they have a product tend to fail. I wondered how that compares to Kickstarter and those types of things where oftentimes they did kind of, you know, dream up some vision for something and then get a lot of people on board and crowdfund. Do you have any stats on that, on how successful it's been in the crowdfunding world?
I know the failure numbers, I don't know them off the top of my head exactly on Kickstarter, but they're relatively high. And I think, you know, Kickstarter's done a lot to improve this over the years. And so I'm sure that it's kind of trending in the right direction. But yeah, I think, you know, Kickstarter is a good model to look to in terms of kind of getting funding on an idea. And that hasn't played out well for Kickstarter.
Okay. All right. And then just nuts and bolts for listeners who aren't familiar yet with these token sales. What is typically the process for buying these tokens? Like if I'm a novice and I have a little bit of Bitcoin or Ether, maybe like a Coinbase or something, and that's it, and I see some token sale I want to invest in, what do I do?
All you do, and this is why it's happening so quickly around the world, is Ethereum makes it dead simple to do a token sale. All you do is create a smart contract and have people, anyone in the world, send Ether to an Ethereum address, kind of at a very high, simple level. That's what you do. So you have, you know, Ether in a Coinbase wallet or whatever wallet you have, and you send a certain amount of Ether to an address, and in return you get a given token for whatever the project is. So it's
and then where do I hold those tokens? Like if I receive them, I'm holding them where, on way, at what address?
In the address that you sent from.
Oh, okay. So you can hold this new token in the same Ethereum address.
Yes. And by the way, I wouldn't do this from a Coinbase wallet because at least now from what I know, they're not supporting sub tokens. I think that will change in the future. But yes, you send from, if you have a Ledger wallet or you know, the Ethereum Mist client or whatever the wallet is, you send the funds and you get tokens, whatever the token is, in return.
Okay. So let's talk more about investing. And before we do that, let's caveat this section with the statement that no one listening to this podcast should take anything that we are saying here as an investment advice. I covered personal finance for a long time and can tell you that if you want advice on your financial picture, you need to talk to a certified financial planner who can look at kind of like everything in your life and figure out what your goals are and all that. Given that, though, there is kind of a lot to talk about from the investment angle. So what is the investment thesis here? What gives a token value?
The way I see it, there's two types of tokens. And I think, you know, everyone has different frameworks. I think William likely has a different framework than I do. But I really think there's two types of tokens that make sense to me right now. One is called a usage token, and one is called a work token. So a usage token is a token that is required to use a service. And I think, you know, the term protocol is used a lot, and I think I think it gets overused. And I think, you know, at a high level, it's simpler to think of these as services. And so Bitcoin is the best example of a usage token. To use the Bitcoin payment network to send, you know, money anywhere, you need to own Bitcoin. And that's really what gives Bitcoin value, is the ability to be used in this distributed ledger that anyone can participate in and no one controls. So the usage token is one type of token. And then the other is what I call a work token. And I think it's still very early in work tokens, but kind of at a high level, a work token is a token that users own that gives them right to contribute work to the network and earn in exchange for that work. And so an example here is Reputation, which is the native token to Augur, the decentralized prediction market. And if you own Rep, you can essentially be an oracle in the system and earn fees. And so you're owning a token not to use a service, but instead to contribute work to a decentralized autonomous organization. And so, yeah, I'm sure William thinks about it slightly differently than I do. But to me, those are kind of the two reasons that tokens have value.
No, this is very good, Nick. No, I agree with your classification. And actually, I talk a lot about the work token, and I did that at my last TEDx. But aside from that, I think the way to think of value beyond the way that Nick describes it is really, at the end of the day, if you think about it, it's about adoption. So forget for a minute about all this kind of new jargon about usage and work and rights and tokens. Really, at the end of the day, if there is no adoption by the users, there's no value, no matter what the vision is, because all of these companies or ICO projects or startups, really, they are all based on assumptions. They are based on a hypothesis that if we issue a token, if we give certain rights to users, if we allow them to do this and that, then they will come and they will use it. But just like any other startup, if there is no usage, there's nothing. So there is a lot here that rests on whether there will be engagement with the users, whether there will be a semblance of a network effect going on. Network effect means every time a user comes into the network, the value of the network increases. And this is something we've been used to for the last 10, 12 years with the internet. But now it's another version of network effects where the users are part of the infrastructure. So the users are all kind of supporting the infrastructure of the network because they are a node on the network.
But right now, when like so many new tokens are launching every day, like when networks haven't really been built out, how does a potential investor decide between them? Is it just, you know, you try to invest in as many as possible and hope that that a few went out, and even if the rest fail, you still make some money? Or, I mean, how do you do that? Or do you just wait until the networks get built? Or
no, I mean, it's not any different than investing in startups. You have to have a hunch, a gut feeling for the team, for the idea, for the product, and then you support them. So,
I mean, is there anything kind of more quantitative than a hunch that you can offer people?
It's really experience. I mean, people think that I am seeing so many ICO projects now that want to reinvent everything. So one of the trends is that we are moving off centralized services. So the other big umbrella theme here behind all of this is there's going to be a decentralized version of everything you can think about, starting with Facebook. So there is like a half a dozen companies now that want to do a decentralized Facebook or decentralized Reddit. Steemit is one of them, and there are five others. Companies are doing decentralized whatever, decentralized banking. So banking without a bank, or Uber without Uber, or a stock exchange without the exchange, because it's decentralized exchanges from peer-to-peer directly. So there is validity in the fact that there will be a lot of decentralized services that will emerge, and some of them will replace the centralized flavor.
But if I'm trying to figure out where to put my money, then how do I decide between one ICO versus another?
So, Laura, I've got a perspective on this. I think like ICO is a misnomer generally, like because it evokes IPO. And to your question about like how do you decide, when you're investing in an IPO, there's a lot of data that you can decide, right? The company's been around for presumably many years, and it has revenue and, you know, all sorts of traction that you can look to. In this case, it's often a founder with an idea and a website. And, you know, William is talking about, you know, you decide like you do early stage startups, which is right, but most people are thinking about this as deciding like investing like an IPO. In startups, the most important thing is the people. And the reality is like most people don't have the time to meet the founders of these projects. And so are basing
it. So does that mean like the crowd really shouldn't be investing in this space then?
No, I wouldn't say that because I think, you know, being inclusive is one of the kind of the fundamental principles of this space. And so but I think maybe the crowd shouldn't be investing before there's execution risk, meaning, you know, when there's a product, I think it makes a lot of sense for teams to give users the product. But I question whether the crowd should really be investing, you know, pre-product when in most cases they're not doing a lot of diligence. Ethereum is the best counterexample to this, right? They raised, you know, 16 or 18 million before a product, and they've executed phenomenally. And there's certainly kind of counterexamples to my belief, but I would bet that Ethereum is more of an outlier than kind of the norm moving forward.
And what about examples where the network launches right when the crowd sale happens? How do you categorize that?
That an example would maybe Zcash. I think, you know, that's an interesting model because when the crowd when the product launches, that's when you give access to, you know, to people. And I think a model like Zcash is a good one rather than raising $15 million before you have anything. And I think that will over time be proven to be the healthy model for the space.
So another thing I was wondering about is sometimes these networks seem to have good business ideas or maybe not so good business. It really depends. But then that kind of analysis is separate from whether or not the token makes a good investment because in that instance, then there's a lot of other factors involved, like how are they distributing the token or how is the token used in this system or just other things. So how should potential investors kind of differentiate between those two things or assess those factors?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's why it's not all about just like getting traction. You have to be thoughtful about like what the token actually represents. And it's why I think kind of a framework for thinking about, is it a usage token? Is it a work token? Maybe, and I'm sure there'll be other types of tokens that emerge. But yeah, the crypto economics, if you will, is really important. And I think it's still super early in crypto economics generally, but there's a lot of really smart people that are thinking about this. That's part of the reason I'm so excited about Token Summit is there hasn't really been an event where most of the kind of leading minds that are thinking about these things are in one room talking about things like crypto economics. So
another factor, Laura, for investing is having a thesis. So one way that investors make decisions is they have a thesis that they believe in, which is a particular view of where the world is going. And that, I mean, if you believe in it, and then when you start to see companies that fit the model that you envision in your own mind after your own analysis, then you start to say, well, this is the kind of company that I'd like to support because I believe in this particular field. So it could be decentralized content. So if you believe that content is going to be owned by the users themselves, and that the publishing and the way it gets distributed is going to be more decentralized as opposed to centralized, then you would invest in such companies. Or if you believe that storage, like computer storage or computing infrastructure, is going to be more decentralized, and if you believe that users will be able to rent a small part of their computers, let's say on a distributed manner, and earn a few cents or dollars here and there. And now we're seeing each sector is seeing now two or three players. Like the example I just gave, there's a company called Storage, there's a company called SIA, S-I-A, and there's a company called Filecoin. They're all kind of vying around the same area of cloud storage. So that's kind of one example. If you believe in that, you would invest in it. There will be cloud computing resources that will be going kind of towards the blockchain, like Golem and others. And so these are kind of like some sectors that are emerging based on a belief of a particular vision that an investor might have.
So I want to jump back to something that Nick mentioned briefly, which is he was talking about, he referenced it and we actually discussed a little bit how some of these developers are launching crowd sales before they have a product. And one of the more extreme examples of this recently was the Gnosis crowd sale, which sold $12.5 million worth of tokens in less than 15 minutes. And they only sold like 5% of tokens. And so at the price sold, that gave this reputation market a valuation of $300 million, which is pretty ridiculous, frankly. So what do you guys make of something like this? What kind of lessons can we learn from this?
Well, the way I explain this is that there is some financial engineering going on here. And the token issuers are getting very creative because there are no best practices. There's no right formula yet. So there's lots of iterations and variations. So this particular one was very creatively done. And theoretically, you could say that the valuation was $300 million because so many tokens exist and the ones that were issued are worth so much. But again, this is all very assumptive, very, very, we're just assuming that this is going to be the case. So the proof is going to be in going to the market and getting users and getting a product to the market. Now, in the meantime, the markets are speculating on this. And this, in return, is funding these companies. So I don't mind a little bit of speculation because it is helping to fund these projects.
But do you think that this indicates that there's kind of more like bubble activity happening? Because a lot of projects have been raising money without without going to this extreme, I would say.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is going to be a point where the market will retract. So we are going to be pushing the envelope and pushing the boundaries to the limits, to the most extreme limits. But if you go back in history of all of the major technological cycles, nothing really ever great was done without some crash of some sort. Without some kind of irrational exuberance, without some kind of euphoria at some point in time. We have to push the envelope beyond the possible and to think that that we can reach the moon before we can just realize what is possible. And then things will grow again. So the crash of 99, 2000 with the internet, back in the internet days, yes, it was bad into itself, but then later, it kind of paved the way for a lot of prosperity that followed.
So right now, there's kind of like a wide spectrum of, I would say, anything ranging from kind of like scams. Like on the episode I did with Jerry and Peter of Coin Center, they talked about Paycoin, which was an outright scam that the SEC pursued. And then there's kind of like less easily detected ones like, you know, maybe the developers raise money, but they never really seem to launch anything. They're always just working on the project. Frankly, like, it's kind of incredible to think like, oh, wow, they could just easily raise millions of dollars and just kind of fund their lives, but never really do anything that, you know, they offer to their investors. So, short of regulation, is there anything that either the community can do now or that investors can do to avoid these types of situations?
I think it's just important to push best practices. And, you know, I agree with William that you know, this speculative activity kind of fuels the ecosystem, and it's natural to some extent. And I also think even from, you know, something like the Dow, which, you know, last year raised $150 million and quickly disappeared, you know, it was a complete failure by all accounts. But even that led to something like the Ethereum hard fork, which I think was a step forward for the whole ecosystem, because there had never been a hard fork in a project that was so significant as Ethereum, and it showed something new that could be done. So I think there's a lot of learning to be done from even the failures, but I do think it's important to continue to be highlighting best practices. And you know, something like Gnosis, which it was the first experiment of a Dutch auction in the space. I think, you know, not necessarily a bad thing that they tried it. And
you just, for listeners who don't know, can you just quickly describe a Dutch auction?
Yeah, it basically lets the market decide the valuation. So the valuation is where the complete allocation, which in this case was 12.5 million, wherever all the bids get filled. And so rather than kind of setting a valuation, it lets the market decide the valuation. And in this case, the market was very excited about the project and decided that the valuation should be, you know, north of 300 million. And that was kind of that experiment hadn't been attempted before. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that it was attempted. And I don't know, you know, the intentions of the founders and whether it was, you know, greed or something else. But I think it's clear to me, at least. And, you know, again, this has only been it's still very new for this is a couple of weeks old. But it's clear that a Dutch auction is likely not a best practice moving forward. But to come to that conclusion, we needed to see it happen before, right?
So, and what are some other things that you would recommend as part of best practices?
I think, you know, I don't know all of them. I don't know. And these are just kind of my ideas. I think it's still very early. And I think that's part of what, you know, we're going to discuss with a lot of people that have actually done it before at Token Summit. But to me, what I discussed earlier, I think, raising a small round prior to doing a big crowd sale is likely better long term than doing a $10 million plus crowd sale before there's a product. So to me, that's like, you know, one of the best practices. Another is, you know, is crowd ownership. So, you know, I was looking at the data the other day, and in the case of like Gnosis, the team only sold 5% roughly to the public. And I think a best practice for public ownership of a token is more like, 60 to 80%, something like that. So those are, I guess, a few examples. And, I don't claim to know all of them.
William, do you have any to add?
Yeah, actually, it's funny. I don't want to mention the token story too many times. We have a session specifically talking about best practices. And the ones that Nick has mentioned are really good ones as well. And again, this is nothing different than how a startup really takes shape. And there is a conventional wisdom that more money, especially initially, does not mean it's not necessarily better. So less money gives more discipline to teams. But from what I'm seeing, discipline is not really the first thing that comes to mind here with a lot of these ICO projects. Many of them see this window and they want to swing for the fences and see it as a one-shot deal where they can raise money at once and then see what happens. Again, trying to emulate what Ethereum did. They raised a bunch of money and then they ran with it. But then luckily for them, there was a big vision behind it, and everybody was rallying behind it. But not every project is like Ethereum. Not every project is like Bitcoin. These are the outliers, or these are more the exceptions, in the same way that in the startup world, not all companies are going to be Facebook or Google or Amazon. These are giants that have become what they are today because of many reasons and many characteristics that were very unique to them. So we are going to see more of those big companies emerge in the next 2 years. But at the end of the day, it doesn't look any different than what the startup ecosystem looks like today, because many of them are startups. And to just one more thing I want to say is that have we learned everything? Not yet. I expect us to make even more mistakes for the rest of 2017 and maybe into 18 easily before we figure out what the real best practices are. And there's nothing really stopping these mistakes from being made, no matter what people like me or Nick and others talk about. And even if we show a bit of restraint and warn people, none of that is going to matter. I think the train is moving at such a rapid speed that right now this mechanism is seen as a low barrier, as a low entry point of raising money, and then everybody is rushing to it.
So to wrap up, what particular tokens or networks are you most excited about?
I could share, like, again, a lot of them, to tying back to Token Summit, a lot of them, the founders of the projects will be speaking at Token Summit. So for anyone that's interested in hearing directly from these people, I think, you know, Token Summit would be a good event. And again, to me, the people behind these projects are much more important than any idea that anyone has. And so a few examples. One, I discussed earlier, Augur. Augur is a decentralized prediction market that they actually did one of the first crowd sales several years ago and have been quietly building since. And I think a lot of people are wondering, you know, what is going on. But I think I'm really excited about what they are going to be bringing to market in the next, you know, 6 to 12 months.
And William, what about you?
Well, I'll mention the ones that I own, so I have to make that disclaimer. The ones that I like that I own include Sia and Storage for cloud storage. I own and I like Steam, which is decentralized content with users being able to earn based on their attention. I like iEconomy, because they are going to be a management platform. Basically, they're going to allow fund managers to manage a portfolio of cryptocurrency tokens very easily. And I like Ethereum, obviously, because they are a new decentralized platform for writing applications. And I like Bitcoin. I also own Bitcoin because they are the backbone currency of this new world. There are others that have some emerging models. I'm very intrigued to see what happens with the reputation markets, with Gnosis and Augur specifically. And then I continue to be amazed by how many new ones are being created on a daily and weekly basis.
Yeah, so we'll see by the end of the year kind of which ones have taken off. So where can people learn more about you and get in touch with you?
So for me, William, I write on a regular basis on my blog, which is at startupmanagement.org/blog. And that's really where my thought leadership is being published.
And Nick?
Best to find me on Twitter. I'm quite active, and we'll certainly, if you tweet me, I'll get back to you. My Twitter handle is ntmoney.
Okay, great. Well, thank you both so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Laura.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Before you switch off this podcast, don't forget, go to surveymonkey.com/r/unchained. Let me know who you are and what you want to see in the show. If you're interested in learning more about William and Nick, check out the show notes, which are available on my Forbes page, forbes.com/sites/Laura Shin. Thanks so much for tuning in to Unchained, which comes out every other Tuesday. And please share the podcast with friends and on social media. And also remember to review, rate, and subscribe to it in iTunes or your preferred platform. Thanks again for listening.